everyone, and welcome to another episode on the Agile Atelier podcast. My guest today is Karen Tenelius on the topic of self-managing organizations. Karen has been experimenting with employee-driven organizations and self-managing teams since the 90s. While studying marketing in her 20s, Karen became interested in a leadership style that is not founded on hierarchical principles. She studied books by Ricardo Semler and became inspired by these ideas. Since then, she has gone on to implement these ideas into practice to help organizations become more self-managing. Karen is also the co-author of the book Mooseheads on the Table. We kick off this episode around the topic of what giving authority to teams looks like in practice. Given her vast experience, Karen does a great job of sharing stories and anecdotes from her previous clients that she has worked with. She then goes on to share insights about how individuals can start to help their organizations be more self-organized, the importance of starting by training and untraining leaders, as well as creating principles based on the team's local vernacular. Lastly, we wrap up this episode by chatting about how one can show the impact of self-organization in a company and the importance of not mixing purpose with method. Hey, Karen, welcome to the Agile Atelier podcast.
Thank you very much.
I'm excited to be chatting with you today on this topic, which is self-managing organizations. And before we dig into the topic, I'd love to ask you about your background. You've been working on enabling organizations to be self-managing since the 90s. So how did you get into this topic and what were your early inspirations?
Yeah, so my access to all that was because I was in the service industry. I worked in hotels and I also studied marketing, especially service management. And in those books, this was back in the 80s, you know, in those books, there were the same message over and over again. To have service quality, you have to have people giving the service involved and give them authority over the business. So that was what they said, all the books. Mm-hmm. And when I then started to work in real working life, I saw the gap between what was in the books and reality. One can say that all my career has been about bridging that gap between what says in the book and the reality.
To just jump in there, did you have a chance to realize or did you really dig deeper into why that gap was there from your experience?
No, I was just astonished and puzzled. I thought, but why don't they do as they teach in the books? Because that seems so clever. I developed an allergy to hierarchies very early. I was a manager, marketing manager in a big education company, training company after the hotel. And this was my last ordinary job, really. Another inspiration was Ricardo Semler. I came across his book, Maverick, also long ago, and that book in detail tells about what he did in his company, so you can picture exactly the processes and the people there. So I carried that book with me for years and dreamed about trying his philosophy and his thoughts out, and then all of a sudden I happened to get to know a hotel manager in a small hotel in Stockholm. And this is 20 years ago. And we decided to try Ricardo's thoughts on her hotel. So that was really my background.
And for those who've never heard of the book Maverick, such as myself, can you share maybe a couple of key points that were included in there and that you tried out?
Yeah, definitely. So Ricardo this was long ago. He was 20 something. He was in Brazil. His father wanted him to inherit and take over the family company. The family company was like 300 people. Ricardo didn't want to because he wanted to be a rock star. and reluctantly, he made a deal with his father saying, okay, father, I take it if you resign and I get all the authority. Mm. And then he got rid of half of the board members because they were very conservative. And then bit by bit, he gave the authority away to people. So in his company, they still had managers, but the employees recruited the manager they wanted by having auditions. So they selected their own managers. He said things like, if I'm supposed to answer mail on Sunday evenings, why can't I go to cinema in the Monday morning, you know? Mm-hmm. So he practiced this freedom and responsibility in a very concrete way. And of course, my interest of it was because this company got really huge. They ended up being thousands of people. And today you can watch Ricardo on TED, you know, on YouTube, and he's engaged in really inspiring projects with villages that are self-organized and such today, schools. Mm. I couldn't let go of that book.
This could be a great segue into the topic for today, which is self-managing organizations. And I thought maybe we could start off by defining what self-managing means to you. Is it what you just mentioned about giving the authority away and having freedom and responsibility, or is it something beyond that?
No, not really. What I found, I was amazed on that hotel where I could see the engagement increase, and from a very engaged level. It was nothing wrong with this hotel business. It was nothing wrong with the manager there. But nevertheless, when we gave the authority to the team, both the engagement and the responsibility increased, and it showed in the figures. So the profits increased in a very short time also, where nobody expected it to do so, because it was also a fully functioning hotel with good profit. So that experience made me think this is something really interesting. And then I started to experiment as a CEO, interim CEO, in small companies. I got several assignments and I gave the authority away completely. And I learned that that was needed to have those effects. And then some people asked me to do this in their businesses, like restaurants and all kind of businesses. And they didn't want to do it fully. And I learned that then you don't get the effects. So for me, self-management is give the authority away completely and trust that everything you dream about happens much, much better and faster if you do. Innovation, expansion, creativity, everything.
So that begs a couple of questions, right? Giving the authority away. Firstly, I'm very curious about how you did that in your role as a CEO. Can you maybe share a certain example of how you gave authority or part of authority away?
The secret here was that the people that gave me those assignments, they were desperate. So I ended up in companies that were on verge of bankruptcy twice. Mm. First, it was a training company, and second was an IT company, and both were in really bad shape. I learned later that people are not as eager to give me the chance if they're in good shape, because they risk so much. But those guys didn't have a choice. They've tried everything. So why not try this crazy?
They had nothing to lose.
Yeah. Exactly. So that's a quite good circumstances to try this out in. And of course, I said to the board, okay, if you hire me, I want full authority on what to do, you know. And also I showed results very, very quickly. And then the board is silent, you know, and when things improve.
Just thinking about self-management as an organization, is that sometimes a means to an end goal, or is that the goal to be more self-organized?
Well, the reason to do is, I mean, if I find a better model, I would happily start to talk about that or use that. But I was amazed by the results, you know, sick leave goes down, staff turnover, all the things. Includes, what do you call it, gender equality, sustainability, environmental awareness, because the wisdom of people is unleashed. So much wiser and long-term decision happens. sustainability, the strongness in a business. So everything that you're after, quality, I mean, it started with service quality, right? So everything that you're sort of aiming for are side effects. And the backside is it's not easy. It's a hell of a ride to have it work, because it's so different from the ordinary.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around something that you've done, right, in your role as the CEO of one of these companies, or in subsequent roles working with different organizations. When you talk about giving the authority away, are you just getting people in the room and just telling them, I'm not responsible for this, or I'm not accountable for certain things, and who would like to be, or how does it look like in practice for you?
Well, traditional companies or traditional organizations are organized in, you know, more or less the same way. They have a management team, they have like sectors or departments. So if you want to do that, this in a bigger organization, the first thing is to have people understand, why should we do this? What's in it for me? What's in it for, what's the point? And what is it? So self-management sometimes is misunderstood to be an it thing, a concept that you have to sort of follow. I more like to describe it as organizing principles, like authority, that you can influence everything that's going on, that you have faith in that you can, that there is transparency around the information so you can take responsibility, that is, it's a culture built on trust and high level of communication, which is needed, and so on. So you start somewhere, and structurally, you don't make a revolution. It's just you invite people to take on their task that they had before, but they work as a team instead of wait for the manager's instructions. So it's exactly the same work, but you approach it in a different way. And it's more of teamwork, deciding together and clarifying what you are doing together.
Okay, so it's closer to what we call a pull system in the Agile and the Lean world, where the team members pull the work rather than the manager pushing the work onto them.
Exactly.
Great. And, you know, as a follow-up to that, a large part of self-management can sometimes be decision-making. And, you know, companies like Amazon, they scale so quickly and effectively, partly because they have an extremely decentralized decision-making process. So is that something that you've also encouraged and enabled within organizations? And how do you do that? And what does that look like?
Yes. So decision-making, when people start to want to go this way, they think that that is something really complex and challenging. But when people start to communicating and listen more to each other, deciding together isn't that hard that you can think. So for instance, in my own company, which is only 20 people, so that's not a big deal, but nevertheless, we take a lot of decisions everywhere. And it's not like everyone are involved in each decision, which is a quite common myth about self-management. In my organization, people trust each other so much, so sometimes it could be hard to engage them in decisions because they trust the people that are most skilled. So you can't really see it. I usually say it's like oil in a machinery, the decision-making. It doesn't show, it's invisible, but it happens all the time. So individuals take decision because they are authorized, teams take decision, and sometimes everyone involved, 20 people, take decisions. And there are different kind of methods for doing this. And over time, every organization develops their way of deciding.
You mentioned two things, having the trust and having the engagement or being there as part of the decision-making process.
How do you balance the two? Trusting your teammate to make a certain decision versus potentially being involved there yourself?
Well, in self-managed organization, there are people being responsible. It could be individuals, but they're not managers, and they are responsible for a function. For instance, like a team or an individual employee are responsible that social media is flourishing, you know, or marketing or so. And if they are responsible to make that happen, they have to be able to decide everything they need to decide to make that happen. So one can say you give them the authority to decide whatever they want. And then, of course, if there is need for limitations in, you know, you can't decide more than 1 million investment or so, there's not so much need for that because people are quite wise and can make good decisions. So it's not so much risk because people want their business to work.
What I'm hearing you say is then the decision types and identifying the different types of decisions that you have within a team, that's not as valuable as maybe giving the teams the responsibility over that area of work.
Exactly. So to organize around trust and knowledge and all the things that employees are, it doesn't have to be so regulated. Me and my colleague earlier today were asked to fill in an inquiry from PwC, actually, our accountant firm. And all the questions were about, you know, how do you make sure and how do you, have you documented the regulations to make sure nobody does something stupid? And having worked like this, like we had for 15 years, people don't, I mean, they function. They don't do stupid things. They don't do evil things. They don't do, you know, when you have trust and a good communication, so you can, you know, ask people, how did you think about this? This doesn't look wise to me, you know, if you have that atmosphere of feedback and straightforwardness, that's also a system to prevent failures.
To switch tracks slightly, I'd like to ask you about your day-to-day work, how you work when you engage with different organizations to help them self-manage, right? So imagine there's a mid-sized company that comes to you and asks you, hi, Karen, can you help us be a little more self-managed? We have some symptoms that we're seeing that it could potentially help with. What are some things that you pay attention to upfront when working with these type of organizations?
Yeah, I have a certain one in mind when you ask, because we worked with an organization with 180 people, and they're both like office surrounding and factory surrounding, one can say. And what we did first, and that's also one of my main messages, if you have a traditional organization with managers, the managers have to untrain traditional leadership. So they have to confront how stuck they are in a paradigm where managers are extremely responsible. And now I don't mean the formal responsibility, but how they're being. So all managers in the world are stuck with one question. How do I get Peter to sell more? How do I get my team be more engaged? How do I? So they are extremely responsible. And this way of relating to their teams won't unleash the capacity in the team. So once when they have confronted that stuckness or how stuck they are, they have to re-skill themselves, especially listening skills, because in the old role of a manager, you're sending, you're talking, you're describing, you're explaining, you instruct, you talk, you visualize everything. But now you have to listen. You have to become like a facilitator instead, if you're still going to be a manager. So that's really crucial.
Is that something that you then coach them through, or do you provide them with some training courses that they can participate in? How do you treat that?
Yeah, we put them in our training courses, and they are quite different from traditional leadership programs. So people would say it's like being in a gym, you know, with a PT, but it's not physical training, it's communication and listening and being training, really. So you train another way of being, another way of communicating, and that feels extremely uncomfortable at first because it's so far away from how you have been. Yeah, so that we do. We put them into training at first. And if you don't do that, you can't move the culture to self-management culture because the impact of the leadership in the company is so large. So you can't neglect that. If you don't switch and change the leadership conducted, you won't succeed. And the next thing is then the atmosphere, the working climate, that needs to be one where people know each other better. They will depend on each other much more, so they will be more friction. So they need to sort of sort out friction and conflicts to reach the psychological safety and be able to be straightforward, to give each other feedback in an empowering way. And of course, they need to learn that. That culture to a certain level that is not reached, then it won't work because collaboration is key here, and to collaborate, that's needed.
I think it's also the ability to raise and address conflicts the right way, like you hinted at earlier, right? So not just collaborating with each other, but also being able to bring up the conflict in a safe manner, right? Without offending the other person. And so how do you encourage that within teams, within groups of people?
Yeah, long ago, we've been in business for 18 years now. So around almost 20 years, it was me who started it because I'm the founder also. So I thought in a group that it was such a big or such a bad working climate. You could sort of sense how hostile, toxic it was. And I realized nothing will work here. You know, whatever we talk about the budget or anything, everything will be just smashed in this horrible working climate. And then I thought to myself, I wonder if you can shift working climates by talking and addressing what is. So I experimented with that for a couple of years and came out with a method where we go into teams that have challenges with trust and silence and talking shit about each other and everything that's happening. And we can help the teams to shift their own working climate to a working one. So that we do a lot. Also in traditional companies, we do that as a service, but a lot in companies that wants to work in a more self-managed way.
Is that a method that you're willing to share and go a little bit deeper into?
Yeah, sure. So it's very easy in theory, but the secret is when you facilitate such a process in a group, you have to relate to them as being responsible for what climate, working climate they have. So they don't look at you as the salvator or, you know, somebody who comes with answers and tips and advice. So you coach them and facilitate, and you have them agree to be willing to talk about the sensitive stuff that they haven't addressed. What they think about each other, what they suspect about each other's intentions, like this person has not the same agenda as the company, and all sorts of fantasies about each other that gets like truths. And we call it moose heads, you know, because it's like talking about the elephant in the room. But that saying, elephant in the room, which is a very good saying, didn't exist in Sweden back then when we started to work like this. So in our version, it became moose heads.
And that is then also the title of the book that you've written together with Lisa Gill. Does it then cover this method primarily of working on the climate and the atmosphere and enabling people to be responsible for that?
Yeah. So we equip teams with a way of talking about the ungraspable. I mean, we can't touch air, you know, but we can sense what's in the atmosphere. And sometimes you can sense it very much. But we don't have a language to manage our own atmosphere in a team. So we train and give tools. Moosehead is one tool to sort of make awareness of what kind of atmosphere we have, put sets of words to it, and then shift it in the fashion we want it to be. And everyone wants respect, straightforward communication, trust, and such. We all want that, but we also equip people to be able to produce that.
One big aspect that I can relate to in your approach is starting with the leadership, right? Starting with the leaders in the company who may or may not necessarily be the people in management, because they have to go first to enable this change and encourage this behavior and so on. So I had a question around that. How do you coach these leaders to ensure that, number one, they're competent, right? You mentioned maybe retraining them on things like listening skills, but also making sure that, you know, they're coherent in what they communicate to the rest of the company, so that there is alignment across the different layers of an organization, so that teams, departments, domains, whatever you call them, are then self-managing.
So most managers are not aware of how not involving they are. They have gone to coach trainings and they think they listen. So one thing is that they need to realize that they have to change and be committed to change. And when we meet managers that are committed to change, we are really straight with them when it comes to feedback, and they get so much feedback on everything that's in the way for them to be listening, to be involving. That's why we call tough leadership training. Tuff is the Swedish word for tough or hard training, because it's really painful to realize that what you thought is not true, and that you talk all the time and you don't hear anything, and that's what it takes to actually shift.
Can you give me an example of when you gave such a feedback and maybe it didn't go to plan? This individual maybe just blew up in your face.
Well, we have so many things to sort of not have that happen, because we don't give feedback to people that are not committed. We create a safe environment. We are not critical. We don't say you're wrong, you know. We have so much around that. But I can give you one example of a quite funny scene when I coached a CEO long ago, and I went to one of his staff meetings and I saw this man. He was like he was in a children's program on television. He talked, you know, like his employees weren't grown-ups or skilled. So he was that. And also he was very, of course, looking at his employees this way made him really arrogant. I know best, you know. I had him in a coach session and I said to him, do you know what's in the way for you as a leader and why people don't align with you here is because your arrogance. I said to him, and he said, well, but little girl, you don't know what you're talking about, you know. And then I said, exactly what you do now to me. So that's sort of, you know, we're very good at hearing what's in the way without judging or criticizing. Just point out that this is in the way, and the managers can't not see that then.
what you mentioned and what you gave an example of is also a powerful facilitation technique, right? Where you basically mirror what an individual or group is doing, and because then they see it from the other perspective, even though they can't or they won't do it by themselves.
That blindness, because it's not like he's not committed to be arrogant, of course, he's blind to his arrogance. If he gets some awareness about it, he can choose to be in another way. So choice here, and what you're saying about mirroring a group. So a group can choose if they become aware.
And also what steps they want to take, if at all, right? So you as a change agent or as a consultant are not coming and telling them do this, do that. Oftentimes you're helping them firstly be aware, like you said, and then secondly, decide what the next step should be, if at all.
Exactly. And there we teach managers to be facilitators, so to say questions that move things forward. And very few managers, traditional managers, can pose a question. They don't know how to do it, you know. So they have to learn what's a question that is a good question that makes something happen, and what's a really idiotic question.
Yeah, I think a really important thing to think about is how the organizational structure and way of working in the past, let's say 50 years, didn't encourage that or didn't incentivize managers being able to listen, being able to be aware, put more focus and emphasis on management as the source of input for their employees. And this is potentially one of the reasons why we see people with such skills in management positions.
Yeah, the management we see were invented or developed 1880 or something, when the industrial era was, where it was completely relevant and needed. But now we want innovation, we want collective wisdom, we want to have use of our very well-educated employees. And now it's not relevant, but we didn't change it.
Yeah, it's interesting to speak about that now, right? Because we're potentially at another inflection point with changing how teams and companies are working with the remote first approach, with COVID and with everything else happening around the world. Do you see some sort of minor changes that are now happening or taking place within leaders in organizations?
Yeah, at least, I mean, I'm in Sweden most of the time, and here is a big difference. I mean, when I spoke about this, which I did as a lecturer 20 years ago, they laughed at me. So I stopped doing that. It was too early. And then we had the agile wave, which helped. And now we have some movement of trust based in the public sector in Sweden, basically, where everyone is sort of agree on the theory of it, at least, not so much the practice yet. So this is very actual, and I mean, it's also that HR are much more popular now because their question are more in demand from the top, who sort of didn't at all consider those soft values or culture. And so, yeah, it's really a lot that have shifted. So that's good. On the other hand, the skills and the insights that's needed to have it work, they are not there yet.
What do you think those are? What are some of those skills that you think are not there that could potentially be helpful?
To realize that the leadership we are stuck in is so outdated, that insight is not. So what people do now, or organization try to do, we start team-based, we start agile, we start whatever. But they underestimate the need for shifting the leadership completely. They think they should do that with the old, or they don't realize it's outdated.
Partly because it's those same leaders bringing in the agile consultants or the different consultants. And the fault is not in them, right? The fault is what everyone else is doing to a certain extent.
Exactly. And also to how crucial the level of communication need to be when people are dependent on each other, and to work together is really painful, and they haven't done that before.
To go back to the topic of self-management from this leadership tangent that we're on, which I'd love to come back to, I want to ask you about some of your biggest challenges that you've seen while working with different organizations when you're trying to make them more self-managing. Are the most challenging situations representing some common theme to you?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So two things, really, if I should select two. So one is that I very seldom meet a top manager, a CEO, the ones who has the whole power that is enough insightful to make the change. And this company that I was mentioning before with 180, they have a woman as a CEO, and she's very insightful and brave, and that has made it possible. But I don't meet them. They are not there, you know. So, and then it's no use. So I just wait for better times there. We have smaller companies with young people, especially in the IT sector, that are something else, and we can work with them. That is challenging. The other challenge is to move culture, because it's one thing in theory, and people agree that, yeah, we should have like feedback culture. Yeah, we should have straightforward communication. Yeah. But it's really something else in practice. And in those processes, they are very turbulent and frightening, especially for the people that assigned us. Yeah. They say, should this be really be like this? Yeah, this is change. This is real change. Mm-hmm. And if change is not like this, then it's no change.
Yeah, well said. With those challenges, what advice would you give for someone who's starting off working with a small organization to make them more self-managing? Where would you suggest this person start?
Making sure that it's not a concept or like a set thing, and equip them with the insight of guiding each organization to find their solution, and get some inspiration of principles, like how does transparency look in our organization? How do we solve authority and decision-making, and get inspired by others, avoiding their mistake if you want, but finding their own way? That I think is the most important.
Yeah, and not just taking a model that works from one company and trying to apply it to your context, thinking that that will help solve your problems.
Exactly. Right? And then also be patient and give it time. You know, if you're 20 people, yeah, okay, let's say 1.5, 2 years. If you're 1,000 people, well, at least 5.
I think the patient part is sometimes underplayed, because we're living in a world where the market life is shrinking, where we're focused on quick outcomes and moving the needle on certain metrics. So how do you communicate this aspect when you are working with different teams or with different organizations?
Well, I'm quite sort of hard. When I take an assignment, I don't do it if there are no prerequisites. So I make agreements, like this company again, because it's the biggest one where we have this large mandate to go all the way, sort of. So we made a 3-year commitment for them to for us to support them. That is now 4 years ago or more. And those years went very quickly, they think and we think. But they have trained all the former managers. There are no managers left now. And this was a traditional company, I tell you. And they have no management team left. They stopped having that more than 2 years ago. They have other structures to make sure they don't lose the whole picture and such. And they have revised all the salary processes. So they have a completely new salary system where peers set the salary instead of managers and so on. So they have accomplished a lot of, a lot of things in 3 years, and they thought it went in a blink.
Yeah, and I think 3 years is also not that big of a time frame for such large changes. Yeah. Within that three-year split, what were the splits within that for things like the performance management, for things like getting having no management?
Yeah, the culture was a big thing because they also had a heritage of the distrust and silence. So we were focusing a lot to shift that, to become a more open. The theme now, which is interesting at the moment, because they are not like there. And that's another thing. You never reach the goal, you know, it's an ongoing process always. But the theme now is that to work together, you have to be so much thorough in what you are doing, like the purpose of the project, the function of what you're doing. You can't sort of trust that everybody have the same picture like you have. So you have to go the extra mile to make sure you have some clarity, some shared understanding, some mental ownership. So it takes much more communication and tools, also communication tools like purpose, which is the most misused tool that you can find, but it's very helpful in teamwork. So that's the phase now, 3 or 4 years later. So there are those themes that you can see.
What you mentioned just now about the purpose, how is it the most commonly misused?
Purpose is mixed up with method. So purpose should be where you're aiming to, or why, you know, or the function is also a good one. Like our team's responsibility, our function is the output more. But people mix how they're getting there. So very often you see teams that are not knowing where they are heading at all. They haven't aligned on where they are going, but they're totally engaged in the road there. But where it, you know, I'm amazed how much of that I see, and I can't understand how anything functions and get done.
It's certainly not uncommon. Karen, to be respectful of your time, I know we're getting to the bottom half of this episode, but I would like to ask you just a few last questions. Going back to something you mentioned at the very beginning of this episode, you talked a bit about the impact of self-management and how you've always shown this potential impact within the company pretty early on. So I wrote a note to come back to that topic. How do you show what is the impact of being more self-managing in an organization?
If you have a traditional view of it, you maybe not see order and sustainability when you look at a self-managed organization. But one of the big benefits is that since the responsibility is so spread, in an organization, there's not so much that are missed out, or it is like this mental ownership that is developed makes the organization very robust. So for instance, in a corona crisis or when something hits the company, as it both did us and this big company I'm talking about, and the CEO there, Anna, she said that we wouldn't have coped so well in the corona without the self-managed developed, like the way of working. And of course, that leads to other effects, being so reliable or stable as a company, not relying only on a few stressed out managers. Of course, also, no, people want to work there. Now we face a lot of challenges finding people because lack of labor force or people to employ. So in TUF, for instance, we almost didn't have anyone who stopped working for us because people thrive there. So that's another good effect of it. It's attracting people, especially before everyone is organized like this. Then you're competitive and people are really curious about and longing for this way of working.
I think it also goes back to the points of culture and purpose that we talked about. So in a sense, you're creating this culture within your organization and redefining your purpose, or defining it if that didn't really exist too clearly before.
Yeah.
And that's something that people can then get behind and work towards.
Yeah. Also, personal growth. People learn a lot, not only a new computer device or like a program, but they learn also a lot about collaborating and communicating and relating to others. So it's like a maturity that evolves.
I think this would be a great place to start wrapping up, Karen. Where can people connect with you online?
Well, our company is called Tough Leadership Training. We have an English webpage.com. I'm on LinkedIn, Karen Tenelius. Just reach out to me.
Great. And I will link those in the show notes for everyone, as well as the Mooseheads on the Table book, which Karen has co-authored for everyone to read up on and check out. Karen, thank you so much for your time, for coming on the show, and for sharing some really valuable discussions with me about self-managing organizations.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Hey guys, it's your host Rahul again. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and subscribe to Agile Atelier Podcast on your podcast app and share this episode with your friends. You can also tweet to us at Agile Atelier. For previous episodes, please visit agile-atelier.com. Until next time.